From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning to you. I'm Ira Melman. Coming your way, the search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 takes a day off Tuesday. Rage by the families of the airplane's passengers spills out onto the streets of Beijing. And Michelle Obama stresses the importance of international education. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. The search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 was put on hold Tuesday as Australian authorities were forced to delay the search for 24 hours because of high waves, strong winds, and dense clouds. Nevertheless, authorities in Kuala Lumpur say they are starting to narrow down the search area in the southern Indian Ocean. Ron Corbett reports from Bangkok.
Malaysia's acting Transport Minister Hishamuddin Hussein says British analysis of data the plane transmitted during its final hours has again reduced the search area for the Boeing 777. Late Tuesday, Hishamuddin Hussein said he is more optimistic about locating the aircraft's last known position in the southern Indian Ocean.
All search efforts are now focused in the southern part of the southern corridor, in an area covering some 469,407 square nautical miles. And this is as against 2.24 million square nautical miles, which was announced on 18th of March. We are currently working to further narrow down the search area.
Authorities have now ended searches elsewhere after concluding that the plane was southwest of Perth, Australia, when it ended its flight. However, investigators have not yet pinpointed the final location of the aircraft. Ships and aircraft from Australia, New Zealand, China, Japan, and the United States have been scouring the region, facing heavy weather in recent days. No search aircraft flew Tuesday, and ships in the region had to move away from heavy seas, but searching is expected to resume Wednesday. Two more planes from South Korea and six Chinese ships are expected to soon join the search effort. Australian Defence Minister David Johnson said Tuesday the search area is an extremely challenging environment.
Remember, this part of the world, this Southern Ocean, has shipwrecked many, many sailors in our history in Western Australia. It is rough. Sea State 7, you know, there are 20, 30 metre waves. It is very, very dangerous, even for big Panamax-class ships.
Satellites and planes have spotted possible debris from the aircraft, but so far there has been no confirmed discovery of any pieces. In Beijing, emotions boiled over Tuesday when about 200 relatives of those aboard the plane marched to the Malaysian embassy demanding more answers and denouncing the Malaysian authorities for their handling of the incident. In Kuala Lumpur, executives of Malaysia Airlines held a news conference defending their efforts to keep family members informed. They said they have given $5,000 to the next of kin for each passenger and are preparing to offer additional money. They also defended Monday's decision to inform families and the world that the Malaysian authorities now consider the flight lost.
Our sole and only motivation last night was to ensure that the incredibly short amount of time available to us, the families heard the tragic news before the world did. Wherever humanly possible, we did so in person with the families or by telephone using SMS as the last resort of ensuring fully that nearly 1,000 family members heard the news from us and not from the media.
Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 disappeared on March 8, less than an hour after takeoff from Kuala Lumpur on a flight to Beijing, with 239 passengers and crew. 153 passengers were Chinese. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
The rage and frustration of Chinese families of those on board the flight spilled out onto the streets of Beijing Tuesday as mothers, fathers, daughters, and sons rallied outside the Malaysian embassy. VOA's Bill Ide was at the protest, and he has more from the Chinese capital.
In a rare public show of defiance, dozens of angry relatives demanded Malaysia tell them the whole truth about what happened to the flight and said they would not give up until they saw their loved ones again. Walking through Beijing's new embassy district, they shouted, "Malaysia lies. Give us back our loved ones."
They're hiding information. Everything they say turns out to be false. Nothing is true or correct, and that's why we're here.
Protests are rare in China, especially in the country's capital. But authorities allowed it to go on, apparently out of sympathy for the passengers' families. The Chinese government is also calling for the truth. It has demanded Malaysia turn over all satellite information used in Monday's determination that the plane most likely crashed in the southern Indian Ocean. Police originally planned to bus relatives quietly to the doorstep of the Malaysian embassy, but in the end, families refused and walked from Lido Hotel, where they have been staying, to Malaysia's representative office. Onlookers reacted with curiosity as the families marched through Beijing's city streets. The rally was peaceful, although emotions ran high. Protesters shouted, "Malaysia is worse than dogs or pigs." Later, one man calls for the Chinese government to come forward, but is quickly told by others to not say that. It was clear from the start that the march was highly organized, with relatives wearing matching shirts and carrying pre-printed placards. But many had more to say. Some wrote messages on their shirts. This woman wrote one character in Chinese, "hate." As the march began to attract crowds, police angrily kept onlookers away. Reporters were forced to remain behind police tape at angles that made it difficult to film straight-on shots of the rally like this one. Despite the protests of family members, Malaysia Airlines says it is doing all it can. But when asked Tuesday whether he should resign, the company's CEO says that's a decision for later. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
The Malaysian-led investigation into the loss of Flight 370 has not yet ruled out a variety of possible causes, including pilot suicide, mechanical problems, and terrorism. Some aviation analysts say the circumstances of the plane's disappearance could give terrorist ideas about how to make other planes vanish, but other analysts downplay that concern. One of them is Hillel Abachai, an aviation terror analyst and researcher at Israel's International Institute for Counterterrorism. Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin spoke with him and asked whether he thinks terrorism played a role in Flight 370.
Well, in this particular case, it doesn't seem to be a terrorist attack. I think it's rather a decision of the pilot or someone on board who decided to crash the aircraft, because all the signs show that it wasn't blown in the air, which usually happens if someone puts a bomb on board, like a terrorism attack. If it was blown at mid-air, as usually terrorists would like to do, we could have found the wreckage already.
What do you think are the similarities and differences between this incident and past cases of terrorism in the sky, such as on 9/11?
Well, first of all, usually the modern terrorists groups, most of them with their ultra-religious affiliation, don't hijack the aircraft in order to negotiate for the passengers. They would like to use the aircraft as a flying bomb, as we saw at 9/11. We know that some of the very extremist terrorist groups have the capabilities of loading the aircraft with explosives with a purpose to crash it into strategic targets. It wasn't the case here. The aircraft wasn't exploded at mid-air, because if it was, we could have seen the wreckage. So, as I've said before, I don't think it has to do with a terrorist attack. Now, another thing that should be emphasized, after 9/11, security measures were taken. Don't say that the security standards on board the Malaysian aircraft or similar to the security standards what we see in American Airlines or in the Israeli airline, but certainly something has changed. So with the chances that someone will hijack the aircraft as a terrorist, I don't think that this is the case right now.
Well, whatever the motive for the deliberate diversion and disappearance of this plane, what do you think that terrorists now have learned from this incident that they didn't know before about how to perpetrate an attack?
Well, I think that the terrorists today are very sophisticated. If we take the 9/11 hijackers, they learn how to fly an aircraft, a Boeing aircraft. They are more highly sophisticated than we saw in the early 60s and 70s. So I don't think they can learn something new from this incident, but I think we can learn that aircraft is still a very preferred target for terrorists. It was before the 9/11 and certainly after it. Now, because of the security standards, we didn't see many incidents or attempts to target aircraft, but these efforts continue. So if you ask me, I don't think the terrorists have learned anything from this incident. What they want to know, they knew even before this incident. They might have learned from 9/11, that's for sure. Terrorists who would like to fly an aircraft, they go and learn how to fly an aircraft. It's not something that it's unreachable today.
Is there any evidence that terrorists are talking about this case?
No, I don't think so, but I think the authorities and the countries will have to learn a lesson from this incident, and the major lesson is that they should cooperate between the countries, because what happened here, as the pilot gave the message to the Kuala Lumpur airspace controls, then he had to switch to another control area, and this is exactly the time where he switched off the transporter. So if you ask me, we, the authorities, the country, the airlines, should learn from this incident that constant communication should be maintained during flight.
Do you have any specific examples or suggestions of how technology should be changed or upgraded in response to this?
Yes, of course. One of the major steps that should be taken is the implemented system which exists that transmits the signals from the aircraft via satellites. And this maintains constant communication with the aircraft. This technology exists, but because of probably economic issues, it wasn't implemented in all the airlines. So what happens today that the pilot transmits or sends them messages every few minutes. But now we have a system that actually sends a sign from the aircraft to the satellite in a constant, the pilot doesn't have to do anything about it. It comes automatically. So the technology exists, and that's what they should implement. This will avoid such incidents to happen again.
That was Hillel Abachai, an aviation terror analyst and researcher at the International Institute for Counterterrorism, and Herzliya Israel speaking with Michael Lippin. President Barack Obama has brought together Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and the South Korean President Park Geun-hye in an effort to mend a frayed relationship between the two Asian nations. The three-way summit meeting took place at the end of the Nuclear Security Summit in The Hague. The U.S. President opened the meeting by telling Abe and Park that a presence is crucial to confronting North Korea. An agreement between the two, both Park and Abe, stressed the importance of cooperation among the three nations. The U.S. has been urging Tokyo and Seoul to lower tensions over historical disputes and focus on issues of common interest, like North Korea's nuclear program. Sung Yoon Lee, a Korean studies professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, talked with VOA's Colin Lovett about the trilateral meeting between the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. He says the meeting between the three allies is significant.
Well, if for no other reason, because there has been no formal sit-down, no formal meeting between the leader of South Korea and Japan since May 2012. And South Korea and Japan have many historical issues between the two countries, of course, Korea having been Japan's colony for much of the first half of the 20th century. At the same time, they are two of the three democracies in Northeast Asia. The two countries are virtual or quasi-allies by virtue of their participation in the U.S.-led alliance structure in the region. The two countries have common interests, they share common values, but they have not been talking to each other.
How does that affect the policy that the U.S. is trying to craft, especially in relation to North Korea and also China?
Well, the United States has found itself once again in the role of trying to be an intermediary between its two allies in Northeast Asia. And this is not a new role for the United States. It's somewhat frustrating for the U.S. It goes back, this kind of role-playing by the U.S., it goes back to the Korean War. The exigencies of the war in 1950 created the need for the United States to bring Japan and South Korea together. And those meetings between Japan and South Korea in the 50s were not very productive, with each side hurling insults at each other. So the U.S. sees, of course, its strategic interests in the region and throughout the Asia-Pacific in terms of, as you mentioned, the long-term strategic competition with China and the near-term as well as long-term threat posed by North Korea with its weapons development and tests and periodic attacks against South Korea and U.S. installations in South Korea. Therefore, the U.S. really wants its two allies to cooperate, to be on board, and not to be bogged down in history, look to the present and the future. And the U.S. has not been successful in that aspect.
Sun Yun Lee, the Korean Studies professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, speaking with VOA's Colin Lovett. Scientists from 100 countries met Tuesday at the Japanese port city of Yokohama, where they are completing a massive report on the threat the world is facing from climate change. While assessing the impact of global warming, the panel says that along with enormous risks, there are opportunities to improve public health and build a better world. The panel's report is part of a series, which also includes one part created last year, as well as another due later this year, that will guide policies in the run-up to a UN summit in Paris in 2015, meant to decide a deal to curb rising greenhouse gas emissions. The first report, released last September, raised the probability that human activities rather than natural variations are the main cause of warming since 1950 to at least 95% from 90% in the 2000 version of the report. But many people in big emitting nations are unconvinced. Only 40% of Americans, 39% of Chinese view climate change as a major threat, according to a Pew Research Center survey of 39 nations in 2013. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama touted America's progress on ethnic equality, civil rights, and religious freedom as she continued her tour of China. Mrs. Obama made the comments Tuesday during a speech to Chinese students at a prestigious high school in the southwestern province of Sichuan. The U.S. First Lady said, in America, hardworking people can succeed no matter where they live or how much your parents have. Later, she observed a student demonstration of the traditional Chinese exercise regime, Tai Chi, and tried a few moves by herself. Last Saturday, Mrs. Obama visited Beijing's prestigious Peking University, delivering a speech that emphasized the importance of education and studying abroad. Our report on education this morning spotlights that speech. Here's a segment of it.
I'm here today because I know that our future depends on connections like these among young people like you across the globe. Now, that's why when my husband and I travel abroad, we don't just visit palaces and parliaments and meet with heads of state. We also come to schools like this one to meet with students like you, because we believe that relationships between nations aren't just about relationships between governments or leaders. They're about relationships between people, particularly young people. So we view study abroad programs not just as an educational opportunity for students, but also as a vital part of America's foreign policy. Through the wonders of modern technology, our world is more connected than ever before. Ideas can cross oceans with the click of a button. Companies can do business and compete with companies across the globe. And we can text, email, Skype with people on every continent. So studying abroad isn't just a fun way to spend a semester. It is quickly becoming the key to success in our global economy. Because getting ahead in today's workplaces isn't just about getting good grades or test scores in school, which are important. It's also about having real experience with the world beyond your borders. Experience with languages, cultures, and societies very different from your own. Or as the Chinese saying goes, it is better to travel 10,000 miles than to read 10,000 books. But let's be clear, studying abroad is about so much more than improving your own future. It's also about shaping the future of your countries and of the world we all share. Because when it comes to the defining challenges of our time, whether it's climate change or economic opportunity or the spread of nuclear weapons, these are shared challenges. And no one country can confront them alone. The only way forward is together. That's why it is so important for young people like you to live and study in each other's countries. Because that's how you develop that habit of cooperation. You do it by immersing yourself in one another's culture, by learning each other's stories, by getting past the stereotypes and misconceptions that too often divide us. That's how you come to understand how much we all share. That's how you realize that we all have a stake in each other's success. That cures discovered here in Beijing could save lives in America. That clean energy technologies from Silicon Valley in California could improve the environment here in China. That the architecture of an ancient temple in Xi'an could inspire the design of new buildings in Dallas or Detroit. And that's when the connections you make as classmates or lab mates can blossom into something more.
Mrs. Obama said international student exchanges can lead to what one student defined to her as citizen diplomacy as international communication increases among students and everyday people. She added such communication need not be limited to in-person overseas visits. More than 200,000 Chinese students are studying in the United States. Only 20,000 young Americans study in China. The Obama administration has set a goal of boosting that number to 100,000. It's called the 100,000 Initiative, strong and 100,000 Strong Initiative. Pardon me. Well, during her visit to China, Michelle Obama has stayed away from discussing controversial political issues. Do you think it is the First Lady's responsibility to engage in political discussion while abroad, even if it may potentially strain relations with the host country? Let us know in our Daybreak Asia Poll of the Week. You can find it at voanews.com/Daybreak Asia. Also at our VOA Asia Facebook page. That address once again on the internet, voanews.com/Daybreak Asia. Also, you can reach it at our VOA Asia Facebook page. Thank you so much for joining us today on Daybreak Asia. My name is Ira Melman. Stay tuned for the latest world news on International Edition with Steve Norman coming up next on many of these same frequencies. Have a good day.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese. It also lets you transfer photos and video directly to Washington. Go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese to get your free Chinese language iPhone app from VOA.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.